This is The Cable.
How much retail ownership is in stock?
Tech story is front and center.
What will this wind up doing to the cost curve?
Your connection from the London market close to the US market action.
A significant sell-off in European assets.
So it feels like a lot of these stocks have already priced that in.
This is a stock that is increasingly being shorted.
The Cable with Guy Johnson and Alex Steele.
Behavioral challenges from the pandemic could linger for years
on Bloomberg Radio.
Good evening, welcome. Monday the 22nd of August, you are listening to The Cable. I'm Guy Johnson, Alex Steele and Charlie Pellett, both off this week. But I have waiting in the wings the notable Marcus Ashworth, who will be joining us to update us on what is happening here. Marcus, I'm looking at a screen that looks fairly ugly. Equity markets absolutely battered today, certainly on the continent. The German DAX down by 2.32%. The euro is now well below parity, trading at 99.35. That's a fresh low for the year. The pound is trading with a 1.17 handle against the US dollar. Bonds have sold off pretty aggressively, particularly at the long end, actually, here in the UK. You've got big moves there. And at the centre of all of this, an energy crisis. Gas prices up in the Netherlands, 13%. That's the European benchmark. Here in the UK, up 14%. It's not a pretty picture.
It is not. And, you know, I don't know where to get the cheer up from, because it's very hard to find anything. And it just seems to get worse. And the only thing I can say is a lot of good bond deals came out from Europe today. There's clearly action, and people are buying and selling new bonds, which is a sign the market is functioning after a very quiet few weeks. So we just have to make sure this gas price doesn't, you know, carry on going up, really. Please.
Getting out of control. Well, on that note, I think there was a sharp sort of intake of breath around the UK a little bit earlier on, certainly in economic circles. UK inflation, this according to a City note that was published a little bit earlier on, UK inflation is on track to rise above 18% for the first time in, let's call it, circa 50 years. This is going to happen at the beginning of next year. This is, to Marcus's point, as energy prices continue to shoot higher. This is a note that came out from Citigroup a little bit earlier on. Basically, what they're doing is plugging in the Ofgem numbers, the expected hike that we're going to see coming through in October, which we're going to find out about on Friday, and then further hikes coming through beginning of next year, and then taking us up to potentially kind of circa £6,000 at some point at the beginning of sort of springtime next year. Now, the last time inflation was higher was 1976, Marcus. That was the oil shock. This kind of feels like an energy shock, certainly, and a broader energy shock. Like, maybe there's some grandstanding here, but a lot of people are coming up with not too dissimilar numbers. But a lot of people are coming up with not too dissimilar. Like, this isn't, they are at the high-end city now, but they're not out of the ballpark.
Well, no, they are at the ballpark, but I mean, the ballpark is stretching. And yes, I know, you know, but I mean, they're all using the same forward gas futures contract. This is not, you know, some form of divining of or Rosetta Stone. This is utter guesswork. And there is no factoring in, understandably, because we don't know yet, of what can be, will be done and will be done by the government to ameliorate this, let alone other factors out there. You know, look at where the oil price is going. And yes, the gas prices are not umbilically linked as they perhaps used to be with oil. But at some point, with recessions coming and a raft of other stuff, I just don't see these numbers happening. And I think it's fuel to the fire. And yep. I find it very nervous.
Have you been surprised that inflation has continued to be as elevated as it is?
I will admit that. It hurts me, but I will admit that, yes. And it's clearly some further stuff coming through, which is going to embed into a lower rate of inflation next year than we have now, but still higher than one might have expected. There's clearly secondary effects coming through. And clearly, you know, this ongoing push up in gas prices in Europe in particular is adding just a much more misery on top.
Okay, we've got a few minutes, so let's kick this around, because I kind of think this is important, how we're getting to this. So joining me now here in the studio in London is David Goodman from our economics team. What do you make of this?
Well, it's interesting you're talking about underestimating inflation there, because it feels like for the past year we have had economists underestimate inflation kind of at every turn, both on the overall peak, but also month by month. They've been, I think it's something like 8 out of the last 9 or something like that. individual releases have been a surprise on the upside. So I guess if we have one missing by kind of 3 or 4 percentage points on the upside or something, that's not that different from what we've seen before. I mean, it's obviously a headline grabbing number. One interesting thing I took away from it was this idea about how it doesn't assume how much help comes from the government, and people were saying that was the reason why it was perhaps too high. But I think that if you look at what help the government could do, some of it is going to come off headline inflation. Things like reducing VAT would, but yep. The kind of direct aid for households we've seen so far from Sunak that's going to kick in this winter. The ONS is still kicking that around to see how that's going to be treated. And
yeah.
I think it may more likely be treated as a kind of income on the income side rather than the prices side. And if that's the case, then you could do a lot on that side of stuff and still not actually make any difference to where the headline rate is. Obviously, it's better for households, but the actual statistics will show a high rate.
Jump.
Yeah.
Right. So, David, you're saying that the ONS is not necessarily going to benefit a headline level of inflation, even though the overall effect may or may not be beneficial, as you said, to the income side of the household balance sheet.
Yeah.
But at the same time, there are other factors. I mean, in the context, and let's not get too highbrow. This is utter speculation. It's fine.
We are definitely not getting too highbrow. Let's make this very clear.
I totally get that they have to. That's the job of an economist. I've done this myself. You know, you have to come up with some form of expectation to lead your clients and lay out your overall economic expectations. And I'm not necessarily having a problem with that. But at the same point, this is predicated on a bunch of forward gas contracts, which are highly liquid at the best of times, very volatile, and subject to manipulation, both good and bad, for whatever hedging needs are needed. And there's a lot of hedging needs going out there. These can fall back as quickly as they rise. And we may be in a situation, if recession were to hit, as we are widely expecting now in Europe and in the UK, probably fourth quarter, if or not, we're all effectively right. already in it.
So you're saying that this the market is saying that the market is, because it's based on the curve, you're saying the market is mispricing gas right now.
Well, I think they're mispricing a lot of things, and mispricing is not quite the right expression. It's just the fact that they have hedging needs are what they are. It doesn't necessarily mean they're people's base case. It's just how you hedge your book out for tail risk.
David, if one of the key inputs into their model clearly is what is happening with Ofgem, and to Marcus's point, we don't have complete visibility on that. How are they getting to the 6,000 in terms of expectations there? Are they simply, as Marcus says, just looking at the forward gas curve and saying, this is where prices are going, this is where the market is pricing, it is efficient, therefore, ultimately, yes, it may be hedging, yes, it may be other factors, but that is where the price is ultimately going to land?
I think so. I think they're looking at where prices have gone in the last week and kind of assuming that kind of sticks. And as Marcus says, that could may or may not happen. We've no idea with the market at the moment. One thing I noticed within their forecast is that their forecast for this week's announcement for the Friday. October price cap is actually a fair bit more punchy than some of the other stuff we've seen. I think it's about 3,700 relative to 3,500. So that's already baked into these figures, is a slightly higher figure for October. So as you say, we actually know all the inputs for that Ofgem number for October, or we should do. So the fact that there's such a broad range shows why. Yeah, I mean, going further ahead, you're going to get an even broader range, and this is why you get these kind of huge differences, it seems, in forecasts out to January and beyond.
Okay. What do we think? Okay, let's assume that the city's at one end, and it's maybe not going to be quite as high as this. What they then go on to talk about is the policy response, and talk about what the policy response could ultimately look like. They see rates, David. If you were to see that kind of inflation and you're going to get RPI north of 20, they see rates having to go to 6 to 7%. Is that in any way possible here in the UK? The bank has been hawkish, but it's not we're in a completely different stratosphere, to use their words, if we're into that kind of environment.
Oh, completely. I mean, I think that we've talked a lot about how high rates could go, but I mean, we're already in that different place now, because if markets are talking about rates hitting 3.5% next year, if we'd been having this conversation 6 months ago, we'd have said that's no way, that's never going to happen. So obviously the situation can change. And with the BOE, you feel if inflation carries on climbing through October, through November, through December, into next year, and stays in I think City's forecast had double digits well into basically into next yep. fall. They're going to have to carry on hiking because you can't stop hiking if inflation is in double digits. Like that, I think that feels like where they can kind of see that path of, because it's just the bank's hands are tied, it feels like, with inflation this high.
Yeah, but David, I mean, in some senses, what a central bank is supposed to look through a bunch of stuff to where its forward estimate of inflation might be in, say, 2 to 3 years' time. I appreciate it still thinks inflation in the UK is going to be, you know, close to where we are now in a year's time. So it is very much hidebound, you know, and that's clearly why the market is pricing in to this, my mind, slightly crazy 3.75% by March. And that's another further 200 basis points of rate hikes, which I don't think we'll get. But I very much get your point, though. Are they going to have to do 50 next time? Yes. Will that push them to do another 25, another 50 possibly before Christmas and maybe more? Almost certainly yes again. But there will come a point where surely they will see perhaps it's the monthly figures you should be looking at rather than the annual headline. And if they start seeing a negative or flat monthly increments, that then they can therefore look through that and actually start to do something slightly more moderate on rate increases. Is that viable?
Perhaps, but I just think I go back to this idea, like, so just looking at Citi's forecast now, which I've got in front of me, September 2023, they're saying 14.5% inflation. The idea that the BOE can kind of conceivably leave rates unchanged much of a kick in now anyway for not acting quickly enough. Can you imagine the kind of headlines if inflation is still up there and they're like, bank sits on his hands and does nothing?
I'd rather read the Evening Standards, you know, read my Pisces, you know, monthly chart than some of this stuff, though, because it is, you know, they have no idea, and try to forecast sensible economic predictions at the moment in almost any category is semi-pointless. Hence the reason why central banks have dropped doing forward guidance, because it leads to no benefit. Are we all not wasting our time trying to pontificate forward things which may or may not happen?
Yeah, I think that's why perhaps there's been some skepticism about this forecast, because it's where we are now, it's very much kind of finger in the air, and obviously they've got their model and they fed in the inputs and this is what they've come up with. But yeah, the bank themselves has said, like, look, we put a lot less confidence in our forecast now than we would normally, and as you said in the past, Marcus, their forecasts normally aren't something to be that confident about. So if they're even less confident than that, then that shows you what, like, how uncertain things are, and kind of, yeah, you're gonna get calls that probably you may see more calls up towards this end, but you may see some come the other way as well, just because that's the nature of where we are at the moment.
Marcus,
the trouble is obviously gone.
No, you go on.
No, I was just going to say, I mean, you can understand if you're on strike outside, you know, Felixstowe Port, and, you know, you're seeing 10% inflation and someone says to you, here's 7.5%, you're going, well, I want 10. And that's, you know, if it does go to 13, 40%, someone's going to want, I want 12, 13. It's very hard to
explain
away.
Yeah. Yeah, how does the Tory government, the next prime minister, survive this? If you are talking about...
Throw money at it. This is all
for how long? For how long? Can you, so,
as long as it takes.
No, I'm being serious, because I've just spoken to a gas analyst who said, actually, don't be worried about this winter, worry about next winter. Because the way the structure of the market is developing at the moment, you could see shortages. LNG, when China comes back, Europe will not be able to buy the same amount of LNG next winter as it will this winter. And that is going to present a huge problem. Say the cost of living stays as high as it is through 2022 into 2023. How does a government manage that? These kinds of incredibly high prices that are going to have massive demand destruction implications.
Well, you know, we do have the fortune of having had a lot of stimulus in our system, which is half the reason why we got these problems now, to rest on. We have a very stable economy in the context of employment, savings, the general corporate, household, banking sectors are all in fine shape, should we say. It's a government debt to ratio, which is not brilliant. It's, you know, in the 90s, but it could be worse. We have a fully efficient bond market, which is actually starved of paper at the moment. You know, we are able to withstand quite an awful lot of pain, which we're going to have to. There's no doubt about it. Truss is going to have to, if it is her, of course, she's going to have to throw 30 to then probably 60 billion at the wall straight away. And there is contingency and ability.
Is that going
to
be enough to get them re-elected in 2024? Is that going to be enough
to
get them re-elected?
I think it's all going to be about, yes, it could be. I'm not saying it will, but it certainly is possible, because what's the alternative? Someone else spending just as much or more in a slightly different way. It comes down to whether or not you think the response and the forward plans make sense. And that we still don't know the answer to.
David Gibbon, thank you very much indeed, sir. Always a pleasure. Love having you on the show. Marcus and I are going to stick with you. We're going to talk about what is happening at Felixstowe next. Strikes have started. What impact will they have? Are they going to be inflationary, these strikes? And how quickly can we find our way around them? That conversation is next. This is Bloomberg.
This is The Cable with Guy Johnson and Alex Steele on Bloomberg Radio.
It is a kind of issue for the logistics industry and the freight industry and the shipping sector here in the UK. As Lizzie mentioned, Felixstowe is the UK's largest container port. But we do have other ports, so they'll help to pick up some of that slack. The issue is, if you do reroute freight away from its traditional travel plans, etc., there will be a cost, and those costs will be passed on to importers, traders, and potentially ultimately consumers.
That was the Ports Association CEO, Richard Ballantyne, speaking to Bloomberg a little bit earlier on regarding the strike that has now crippled UK's biggest container port, Felixstowe. It's going to be on basically all this week, but the effects of which could last for much, much longer. Joining us now for more on this story is Bloomberg Managing Editor for Global Business, EMEA, Eric Fanner. Eric, talk to us about the effect that this strike is going to have, both in the near term and potentially in the long term.
Yeah, so in the near term, I mean, it means a shutdown of the biggest container port in the UK, handling about one third of the container traffic. That's obviously in a situation where you've already got tight supply chains, rising costs, shortages of some goods appearing, you know, from time to time. That's not helpful. It means that shippers need to find alternative sources or routes, rather, to get their goods into the UK. Doesn't mean people are not going to get fresh food, things like that. That tends to come in through other routes, like the ferries and the tunnel on trucks rather than containers. You're talking here more about consumer goods, you know, non-perishables, things like that. But that stuff, you know, starts to pile up as well in other places and doesn't get sold, and you get shortages at stores eventually. It depends how long it goes on, of course. At the moment, we're set for an 8-day strike, and that could extend. Other ports could see similar tensions potentially. So that's one effect. The other big thing is inflation, which is already rising and getting pretty alarming in the UK. The more shortages you get like this, the more inflation you get, the more, you know, the cost pressures will keep rising. So those are kind of the twin effects that you're going to see here.
So, Eric, it's, you know, obviously this seems to be a bit of a point of principle, which is keeping the sides apart here, but they're not miles apart. I think 7.5 plays against 10, that there's also a cash payment involved. Do we sense there is a reasonable chance there could be a rapprochement before this strike is embedded, or are we set for, and your best feeling for this, more like the train strikes, which are going on at the moment, which seem to go on forever with never a chance of the two sides coming together?
Yeah, that's an interesting question. And of course, yeah, it would take a bit of crystal ball gazing. I mean, as you say, I think that, you know, that they're not miles apart. On the other hand, some of the rhetoric that you're getting from the unions, and we're seeing more of it today after some of the inflation forecasts were notched upward further from some analysts, with some of the union leaders saying, well, wait a minute, maybe we should hold out for even more. So all of a sudden that gap between what they had said they wanted and what's being offered, you know, starts to potentially widen again.
Eric, these ships are going to go basically to other ports on the continent. And as you say, the containers are going to pile up there. You're going to get then the short sea routes bringing some of that container traffic back in, potentially to other ports, or it'll just sit there and wait for this strike to go over, or it'll come back round via the tunnel, etc. How quickly can we unwind this 8-day strike, though, in terms of the impact it's going to have with those containers sort of stacking up? Is it going to take kind of 2 or 3 weeks to fully unwind the effect of an 8-day strike?
Yeah, I would think you'd be looking at something like that. I mean, it's interesting. We saw a bit of this kind of thing actually in reverse, last year or during the COVID pandemic when some of the ferry traffic was disrupted and the tunnel traffic because of the truck driver shortage and COVID testing requirements and that sort of thing. And you saw some of the traffic there being diverted the other way. And that caused disruptions for we also had disruptions at Felixstowe due to truck drivers as well. That affected fuel. And so those things, they tended to take a couple weeks to sort out. Now, in this case, potentially if these things drag on, if they don't come to an agreement within that 8-day period, then of course it goes on longer than that.
But, I mean, Eric, I mean, thankfully I don't have small children anymore, but we're not talking quite yet of not being able to get the latest Cabbage Patch doll is these days. We are talking about Christmas still going ahead, aren't we?
Yeah, I mean, you do tend to get some alarmist stories about Christmas being canceled. That's become a bit of a theme in the UK in recent years, for various reasons, and that tends to bring it home, I think, for consumers. I mean, obviously these companies and retailers do need to order stuff in advance. This is a good time to bring it in before the selling season gets underway. I don't think an 8-day strike at this point at one port is going to cancel Christmas, but it's definitely going to be a bit grinchy potentially on your wallets, and if a certain product has a real run on it, yeah, and this thing goes on, then all bets are off, right?
Final quick question, Eric. The situation we find ourselves in here in the UK is we've got a range of strikes now underway. Is there a situation where we now find ourselves in where actually there is a sort of aggregate effect of all of these strikes, and that is the desire? You want to have different bits of the economy being affected at different times, and that's where you're going to get the maximum pain from the unions. The train strikes are one thing, then you pile up a port strike on top of it, you get another strike here, you get another strike there. It creates an impression from the unions about what is going on. Do you think that's what is happening here, to Marcus's point about trying to resolve some of this?
Yeah, I think that's a really interesting point. And there are other disruptions as well, other strikes as well. We've got the barristers striking. We've got the Royal Mail, the postal workers later this week are set to strike. There's been talk of other, public sector workers. Clearly, there is something broader going on. It's been called, the summer of discontent in the UK. Other countries are seeing labor action as well, but the UK is particularly... Yeah. It seems to be on the cutting edge of this sort of thing. And of course, that tends to help the union case to a certain extent if there's a sense that,
Eric,
everybody is pushing for this.
Great stuff. Thank you very much indeed. This is Bloomberg.
This is The Cable with Guy Johnson and Alex Steele on Bloomberg Radio.
Good evening. Welcome back. 5:30 in the City of London. You are listening to The Cable. We are live on DAB Digital Radio. I say we. I'm Guy Johnson in London. Marcus Ashworth joins me. Alex Steele is out for the week, enjoying a well-deserved break. Financial markets look a little bit like this. European markets closing firmly in the red, led lower by the German DAX today, down by 2.32%. The car makers in particular were under pressure today, but industrials broadly across Europe have had a very, very tough day. Energy prices have been spiking. UK nat gas is up by 14.21% today. Over the last 30 days or so in Europe, we have seen the cost of nat gas go up by circa 70%. It is a huge pop that we continue to see day by day. That is now starting to be priced into the currency markets. The euro has fallen sharply today. We're seeing broad dollar strength. We are now trading at spot 99.45. We are at the lows of the year for the euro. The pound is also under pressure on the cable rate. We're trading 117.75. The bond market generally has been on offer today, despite the fact that we are expecting yields to go sharply higher, driven by central banks. We are seeing a big kind of repricing today as a result of that. But it does stand in stark contrast to the economic news that we are getting, of the concern these high energy prices are going to have a major impact in terms of growth. Another story that we've been watching very carefully today has been what's been happening in the banking sector. We continue to watch what is happening with Credit Suisse with interest. I feel like I spent the last 10 years talking about Deutsche Bank and the troubles and trials that it has had. Marcus, Credit Suisse has definitely taken over that mantle. And the gloves apparently are finally off in Zurich. We had a whole load of chief executives that have sort of tinkered and sort of tried to figure out how to get the investment bank and Credit Suisse to work. But it's lost and it continues to lose money. And so far this year, it's lost circa $1 billion in the first 6 months of the year. Now, apparently, we are going to see the latest management team coming in, led by Ulrich Körner, and basically laying waste to all of this. Was this inevitable, Marcus?
Well, in some senses, yes. But I mean, the great thing about Credit Suisse, if there's a rake to stand on, they'll rush for it first and step on it and get whacked in the face. And it essentially, it's their risk culture throughout everything you look at, from green sill to structured notes, the SPAC rush. They go for risk in a very aggressive, leveraged way. And that's the problem with cleaning this bank up. And if you look to the Swiss compatriot UBS, who, you know, a decade or whatever more ago, took a really, you know, big meat cleaver to their investment bank. Quite bizarrely, we all thought at the time, because, you know, they got rid of a lot of very good and profitable businesses. But they did it to get, you know, basically their costs down and to get the, you know, return on equity to a level whereby they would be and have been, you know, rewarded with trading above book value ever since, whereas everyone else has wallowed trying to get away with it, you know, Deutsche being the most famous one perhaps. But Deutsche Bank have got lucky, I think, the last year or two. Their trading business, which is ironically the thing they were not going to focus on, has bailed them out. Credit Suisse is in a unique situation. It has a wonderful sort of image and private banking and wealth management arm, which is people associated with. However, it's got this legacy of a very US-based businesses from First Boston, from DLJ, Roth, other things, which has got a lot of businesses they can't get rid of very quickly, particularly on the securitization side, which they've been very aggressive in building up. That's a long-term business. You can't just clip that off, fire a bunch of people and move on. So, you know, yeah, they've gone through the management ranks. I don't think there's anyone left now from, you know, a year or two ago. Maybe the new lot has had a better chance of going at it. But, you know, the point is you get in the spiral, don't you? The people you want to keep leave because they know that even they get locked in for a bit, it's only going to last for so long. You can't retain and grow businesses, and you're forced to keep on cutting into more and more, you know, into the void. Difficult. Merge.
No, well, that's
the key thing.
And that's one of the tricky things. Let's get another voice on it, another take on this. Alison Williams covers global investment banks over at Bloomberg Intelligence and joins us now on the line. Alison, Marcus kind of lays out what is happening here and talks about the difficulty of shrinking an investment bank that is a complicated machine. How easy is it for management to change this business, to shrink this business down to a size that they feel represents the right kind of level of risk?
So it's tough, and we've seen that, you know, over the last several years with the firm sort of, you know, trying to do things at the edges. And I think, you know, just after one too many missteps and reported losses, something more drastic obviously had to be done, and that's why we're getting the management change and talk of being more aggressive. I think investors, you know, always over the long term, you know, really tend to favor the wealth management businesses at Credit Suisse and UBS, and have always wanted to have a smaller investment bank. There are definitely parts of the investment bank needed to support the wealth asset management business. So, you know, M&A is a big one of those, and that I think is why that business is considered to be, you know, quote, relatively safe. But for Credit Suisse, if you look over the long term, you know, their areas of strength, cash equities has historically been a strong business, and the overall equities business was strong about a decade ago, but they've definitely shrunk some around the edges there. And with prime brokerage, it's, you know, that there's the exit there, and then you were definitely seeing some ancillary impacts to the other businesses. So to your question, you know, about how do you shrink it, to some extent, the market is doing some of that work for Credit Suisse in terms of, you know, cutting down that business. I think the big question is the securitization business that Credit Suisse has. It's relatively unique. You talked a little bit about how Deutsche Bank is faring better. I mean, part of the issue with Credit Suisse is that the areas that the bank is in the investment bank, the areas that they're strong in, such as cash equities, such as the securitization and credit trading business, are just not the, you know, those businesses have been under pressure, especially in the environment of the last 6 months, and look to continue to be so, just given some of the market trends. They talked about raising capital, outside capital, for the securitization business, but that seems very difficult in terms of execution. I'm not sure how they can carry that out. So I think, you know, I think that the point of saying that is, I think they wanted to really come across and say, look, like, we are going to be, you know, we are going to do something more than trimming around the edges. We recognize that something more has to be done. You know, the question is what really happens in terms of the execution there.
So Alison, you're talking about potential either hiving off or partnering perhaps on the securitization business, but we're not really talking here Credit Suisse merges with UBS or Credit Suisse gets sold, you know, in some shape or form, because it's a national champion. The Swiss government won't let. It's shrink. Is there any way out of here?
I think so, because, you know, even though, you know, we in the investment community like to speculate about deals, I don't see a U.S. bank coming in. I think, if anything, they would just, you know, they would seek to aggressively go after individuals in the business and seek to do it that way. They've already had some success there. I think that is what they would do. Obviously, the wealth business is a very attractive business to overseas buyers. But to your point, you know, it is a national champion. Part of the issue why UBS and Credit Suisse are more regulated than many of the other global banks is that their size related to the Swiss economy is already sizable. So I think that prevents a merger.
Alison, great stuff. Thank you very much indeed. Bloomberg Intelligence's Alison Williams. Up next, we're going to talk about the European energy crisis. That's next. This is Bloomberg.
This is The Cable with Guy Johnson and Alex Steele on Bloomberg Radio.
Good evening. Welcome back. You're listening to The Cable. We are live on DAB Digital Radio. I'm Guy Johnson alongside Marcus Ashworth. So the question we were debating a little earlier, Marcus, on television, was whether or not really you need to turn up for Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday and Thursday of this week. Friday is all that matters, certainly for US investors. Jay Powell is coming up. How important do you actually think it's going to be?
I'm trying to write something about it at the moment and I'm struggling. You know, it seems to be he has to sort of eschew this sort of dovish pivot, which people try to label him of having done at the last press conference. Certainly all the rhetoric out of Fed heads the last week or two has been increasingly hawkish to not that much response, though. I think the bond market today is starting to sort of get a little bit worried about it, perhaps. So the question is, you know, do you crash the economy to curtail inflation, or do you try and wing your way through it and hope for some form of, you know, putative soft landing? You know, no one's quite certain yet, despite the Fed sort of talking tough and indeed acting tough. If you think about, you know, close to $1 billion a month off the balance sheet, and at the same time, you know, not just but 75 basis point rate hikes, and I think we might well get another one, just to try and drum home the message that the Fed isn't going to stop here. But it's difficult, you know. This is the annual think, and like, let's think of the latest policy and what should we be doing next differently. I don't think the luxury is there this time. They've got to perhaps, I wonder if they will do, I hope they do, a bit of a mea culpa and say, look, we got this so badly wrong, all of us. You know, why did we sleep at the wheel? Why did we leave Simmerson for too long? And how will we better somehow try and get a grip on trying to forecast inflation? Powell has mentioned that they don't know much about inflation. He said that at the equivalent ECB thing in Cintra in June. So, you know, maybe we might get a little bit more sort of, you know, what can we do in a situation like this? There's not little we can do in forecasting it accurately, but we will do X and we'll do Y. And I think, unfortunately, at some point, he's going to have to ram home this point that the economy is going to have to suffer.
yeah, we may have to actually generate quite a large amount of demand destruction and, as you say, potentially cause a recession. One of the factors that the Fed is not having to fight at the moment in the way that the ECB is, and it's going to be interesting to hear from Isabel Schnabel speaking at Jackson Hole as well. I think she's going to speak towards the tail end of the week too. It is the energy story. Energy prices have spiked sharply higher today. Once again, you've seen the Dutch contract up by around 13%. The UK contract is up by around 14%. They were up even more than that earlier on. This we hear from, once again, the Russians, that they are going to conduct maintenance on the Nord Stream pipeline, Nord Stream 1. The pipeline is only operating at 20% capacity at the moment, but they feel that they need to do further maintenance on that pipeline. It may only be out for 2 or 3 days, but this comes at such a critical time as we're heading into winter. Let's bring Todd Gillespie into the conversation. He covers European power, gas and renewables here at Bloomberg. Todd, just walk us through the reasons we've seen this latest spike.
Hi, Guy. Yeah, well, I mean, the main thing is that Russia's basically said that it needs to take down the Nord Stream gas pipeline for 3 days of repairs from August 31st. So it again raises this fear that Russia is, you know, sort of concocting excuses for basically putting out of business, putting out of action Europe's energy supply. We've seen it with this issue with the gas turbine with Siemens, and lots of speculation essentially that Russia was doing this in order to manufacture a crisis, coming up with new reasons one after another to essentially constrain supply. And obviously that freaks out traders. Every time you do that, you're basically freaking out the market and saying, hey, you know, for years we've been a reliable supplier, but actually, you know, now maybe, you know, there's something new that sort of comes on, you know, comes onto the table and means that we need to put this out of action for a while, basically beyond the scope, beyond the remit of what anyone would ordinarily expect.
Todd, not to be too simplistic here, but I like it simple. Would we put this down to today's price action, basically pretty much all being down to this three-day closure and then playing rope-a-dope with us in a sense that illustrates how skittish, how illiquid, and, you know, how perhaps the forward hedging of requirements are so all over the place? It, or is that, or am I missing other factors or something a bit more complex?
Totally. I mean, it is quite simple. I mean, this market has been on edge for months now. You're seeing in the power market, especially, you see trading happen sometimes 2.5 hours, 3 hours, the first trades come through on the exchange after the market opens. Basically, traders are sitting at their keyboards, like, you know, hesitating with their fingers over the mouse, waiting for someone else to make the first move. This is like, you know, in normal times, you'd see, you know, the market open within a couple of minutes, you'd see a trade. Now you're seeing people really on edge, very, very skittish, as you said. I think that's a really good, you know, term to describe this. And any little indication from Russia over what they're doing with, you know, Europe's infrastructure and sending gas is, you know, it's the main driver across the board here.
Marcus and I were debating this a little bit earlier on. Citi put out a note a little bit earlier on. Yeah. And they were predicting 80% inflation in the UK going forward. And the basis for that was the forward energy curve that we're looking at right now, the forward gas curve, which they're extrapolating into the Ofgem price hikes that we're going to see on the cap. How accurate, how useful is that forward curve at the moment?
Yeah, I mean, that's a million-dollar question. I think you could say that, I mean, it moves up and down all the time. I think one thing that you can consistently see is that people are pricing in risk, you know, constantly. We're not just talking about, you know, traders having to sell at higher prices because the wholesale cost itself and the supply is tightening. But you're also seeing traders having to, you know, trade at higher prices because of collateral. You're having to see people pass on costs to heavy industry that are higher just because they need to insure themselves against risk in the future. So there's a lot of components that sort of constitute these prices. I mean, I must say as well that, I mean, the Ofgem price gap, that's one thing for households as well in the UK, but you're also talking about massive business costs too. Which aren't protected by any kind of upper limits. I mean, I've spoken to restaurants and heavy industry today. You know, some of them are putting themselves on flexible contracts, so they don't even have to, you know, they're not hedging at all. They're essentially buying on the day-to-day market. And some of them are essentially just switching off and lowering output, depending on what the daily spot price is that day. That's sort of how on edge industry is right now.
So, do you have any good news at all, Todd? No,
but if you do,
it would be great.
I did hear one interesting thing actually yesterday from a good source who basically said that a lot of his big manufacturing customers are taking this as such a shock that they are rushing to put solar panels on all of their buildings because the payoff for solar has massively sped up. So previously it was about 12 years to pay off a solar panel. Now for some of them it's 1 year. I mean, that's how expensive electricity has become, that the price of installing solar.
Can you get the solar? So there's that. Yeah. That raises two questions which I'm interested about.
Mm-hmm.
A, is there the capacity? Do we have enough solar cells if everybody wanted them to do that? And B, is there enough of a trained workforce to then come and fit them?
No is the answer to both of those questions. Yeah, I mean, that's a massive thing as well. You know, we're talking about existing supply issues across the board that are already biting into industry, biting into renewable supply sector. And if you talk about batteries as well, I mean, a similar thing is happening. You see issues with lithium supply. I'm not pretending that that's going to be a magic bullet by any means, but it is forcing businesses to look at their energy efficiency and driving net zero as well. We're looking at some of these big users really, being resourceful and stepping up and accelerating plans, things that they were going to be doing 5-10 years from now, they're doing as soon as possible, some of them before October when their contract renews.
And when winter starts, just going to point that one out
exactly.
As well. Timing is excellent.
Isn't summer? Summer's now, isn't it? Yes, you're absolutely right. So, I mean, Todd, there are some good things, I think, putting apart that the European and the UK and Norway and the rest of it haven't got together for like a whatever number you want to call it, summit on it and try and hammer stuff out. But behind the scenes, there does seem to be an amazing level of European integration working with each other. I mean, there was one day when we had to pay some ridiculous amount from Brussels to kick up a coal plant because the East End of London was about to close down. But equally, at the same time, the UK has been, presumably profiting as well, but supplying a load of energy across to Europe, particularly France, I believe. So as long as we can persuade Norway not to get too possessive over their own sort of natural gas over the winter, there is some semblance that everyone's trying to work together and help each other out. And at least the gas storage in Germany is getting, well, I wouldn't say it's not yet at 95%, which is presumably they can't add any more after that, but at least it's getting much better than it was.
Yes. So, I mean, I think that's an optimistic tone. I mean, I think one thing I would say about the France situation, which is a lot of people have reminded me, is that, historically we import electricity from France during the winter because we get tight and they have this massive nuclear capacity, which is normally, doing quite well. Obviously, the opposite is on the cards for this winter. And I think we've already seen, a few times recently, we've seen the sort of grid operators essentially having to coordinate between the UK and France because France is basically trying to pull more electricity from the UK than the UK is willing to give on the grid. And I feel like when we get to winter and, supply and demand get really quite tight, we're going to see potentially more instances like that and some of that, which might even build up to some political tensions. I think also if we're talking about European cooperation. I mean, looking at who's set to be the next prime minister, I was having this discussion with some editors today. I mean, we're talking about big reforms to the European energy markets that would be needed to kind of, make any sort of reform sustainable. And the sort of rhetoric that we're hearing out of the likely next prime minister, Liz Truss, in terms of dealing with that and cooperating with Brussels on something like this, I think that might be a big ask for the current Conservative Party to do.
Okay, that's an interesting point to leave it. Thank you very much. I that was pretty interesting. It'd be interesting to see whether the Norwegians are prepared to lower their prices. And I have to say, the cooperation point, I don't think has hit its toughest spot, I think. Todd, great stuff. Thank you very much indeed. Todd Gillespie, Bloomberg European Power, Gas and Renewables reporter. That's the... I, Marcus, I take your point about the fact there's been cooperation thus far, but it hasn't got crunchy yet.
No, it hasn't. And I do take the point. I think, you know, look, there's an awful lot of play. I don't think we should reach into what's going to happen with European relations. But other than that, it's, you know, when it comes to it, you know, probably it goes back the other way. Will there be a rapprochement? I mean, the other thing about the Norwegian supplies, these are long-term contracts. So they're not going to be all of a sudden Santa Norway coming to deliver us, you know, much cheaper gas. That's just not going to happen. It's more about availability, and we've seen with Germany. Germany's been prepared to pay very high prices to secure what it can secure. That has left a lot of other countries in a difficult situation, because bear in mind, it's not just Germany's reliant on Russian gas. There's a raft of other Eastern European countries which are in a very difficult situation. So, yeah, it's going to require a lot of rapprochement and coordination and a general sort of, that's why I say I think that it would be good to see some form of getting ahead of the problem, having a more of a global pull together on this.
Well, okay, so you bring up global, and global's interesting because China, so far Europe has outbid Asia for energy contracts, but China's not really competing in a big way at the moment.
But India is.
But India's being outbid. China has deeper pockets. And you do wonder whether, if you were to see... This is the point about next winter. China's not back yet. So we've basically got a year to get this sorted before China comes back and starts buying LNG cargoes, which it's not doing in a big way right now. And that's one of the problems that I think we're going to face. The problem I have with all of these conversations is that we seem to be treating it like a 1 year, 6 month problem. But let's say it's not. Let's say it's going to take 10 years to get through an energy transition. Let's say the first two or three of those can be very bumpy from an energy point of view.
Yeah, well, we have failed to fix the roof when the sun was shining with very low interest rates and indeed plentiful energy supplies, at least we thought. And clearly there's only so many sort of wind farms on Dogger Bank one can build and get them up and running. But, you know, there are some good signs. I mean, Centrica's done a very big deal. A lot of supply coming across from the US. There will be, you know, other wider ways of providing supply, one hopes. It's the question of, will we avoid at some point a mass need and lack of supply? Yeah. I think that's certainly coming. And you're right. I mean, obviously next year and the four contracts are pointing to big problems there. That's something which, you know, I'm almost too scared to even have a think about, actually, because I think getting through the next 6 months is impenetrably hard enough to work out that what happens after that is like there'd be dragons.
Well, if you're putting short-term fiscal in, if it suddenly turns into a longer-term problem, then you've got a much bigger issue.
Exactly the reason why you could argue it's been short-termist than perhaps the French and the German approach, in the sense that particularly the French approach, they've tried to, you know, putting a cap on doesn't solve anything. In fact, it makes it worse.
Okay. Marcus, great to have you along for the ride as ever. Thank you very much indeed. This was The Cable. This is Bloomberg.